Welcome to the Home Base Podcast, the podcast where we explore the keys to college success and personal growth. I'm your host, Dr. Ricky Pope, and today we're deep diving into how students can survive and thrive in their college journey. For this first series, we're collaborating with the Young Men of Color Alliance, an organization committed to supporting young men of color through mentorship and community initiatives. Today's episode will focus on giving you the tools and strategies to take control of your academic experience. We will discuss the importance of developing agency and the power to make choices, shape your future, and overcome obstacles. Welcome to the Home Base Podcast. In today's episode of the Home Base Podcast, we're honored to introduce Trino, a dedicated educator, community leader, and U.S. Marine Corps veteran. He brings a wealth of experience to our conversation, drawn from his years as a college professor and a lifetime public servant. With a BA in political science and MA in history from the University of San Francisco, where he was a part of the NCAA championship-winning soccer team, he went on to earn his PhD in history from UC San Diego. His commitment to teaching excellence was furthered through training in UC Berkeley's graduate program of education, where he obtained a secondary school and community college teaching credential. Throughout his career, he has worked tirelessly to foster positive change. He's been an advisor, presenter for numerous government agencies and community organizations, including the Hispanic Bankers Association, the Latino Peace Officers Association, and as a member of the Neighborhood House Board and founding member of, of the first San Diego Board on Police and Community Relations, as well as a later role on the Chula Vista Police Community Relations Board. He has helped bridge community and institutional relations for decades. I'm really excited to sit down with Trino and understand some part of his story. Welcome to the Home Base Podcast.
I'm glad to be here.
So just, that's a, you've lived a robust life, and just kind of thinking about some of your career, what would you like us to know?
Well, I am a Latino immigrant from Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. And that's important because I served as a role model for immigrants in general, not just Nicaraguans, but immigrants in general. Here's a guy who came when he was 14 years old. 3 months later, I became a U.S. citizen, mm-hmm. a proud U.S. citizen, mm-hmm. and 3 years later, a proud U.S. Marine.
Mm-hmm. So what drew you to serve as a Marine?
I was a graduated from high school. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the support of my mother because she was working as a, in a sweatshop.
Okay.
And she was making minimum wages, and my father was not in the picture. So I looked at my options, and one of them was the Georgetown School of Foreign Service. Mm. But then the cost of that, it was impossible for me. And so I decided to, my other choice was the U.S. Marine Corps. It appealed to me because of the discipline and the fact that they were the best.
So going into the Marine Corps, what did you learn about yourself? Because it's a kind of a different experience than going to college right after high school.
Well, one thing the Marine Corps is good at, they give you credit for trying. Mm. They really do. I try my best, and I excel in everything that I did. Physical training, big thing in the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. Just to give you an idea, when I made Corporal E4, there were 90-plus Marines eligible, and they only made four were promoted, and I was one of the four.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I made Sergeant in the most elite unit in the Marine Corps, mm-hmm. Force Recon mm-hmm. Company. Mm-hmm. So I did well.
Mm-hmm. So Force Recon, what's that?
Well, that's an all elite unit.
Okay.
Like the Navy SEALs, Green Beret, that type of thing. And so we have our own But, you know, we don't get the headlines like the Navy SEALs do.
I see. And so how long did you serve in that capacity?
Well, total in the Marine Corps was 7 years.
Okay.
In that capacity, that's when I went to Vietnam.
Okay, so you went to Vietnam.
Yes.
Okay.
The trip was free, you know, round trip.
Stop it. Okay, and so what was that like? Like, what was your experience? Because we can, you know, students can learn about this in their history books, but you're living history.
Well, yes. You know, André Malraux, the French writer, said, the deepest experience in life is a foretaste of death. And when I came back, I realized it. Also, in the Marine Corps, they have this saying, the more you sweat in peace, the less you bleed in war. Hmm. And I thought, well, yeah, that's good, because we've been sweating a lot in the training.
Yeah.
So it was good. It really fitted with my image, mm-hmm. to do my best always. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Marine Corps expects from mm-hmm. you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so at some point you have this career in the Marine Corps, but then you leave at some point.
Well, yes, I never intended to make a career.
Okay,
I was dreaming of becoming a Foreign Service officer. Mm-hmm. However, since I'm from Nicaragua and they had a dictatorship there, military dictatorship for the last 40 years, ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to do something about that. So all the time I was in the Marine Corps, when I was training, I kept thinking, hey, I can use this in Nicaragua to overthrow the dictatorship.
Oh, my goodness.
It just crossed my mind.
Oh, my goodness. So you were how old were you when you were thinking of this?
17,
oh
18.
Oh, my goodness. So there was this part of you that wanted to go home, or?
Well, just to get rid of that guy and come back.
Okay. I see.
This was my home.
This was your home. Okay.
Yeah. And eventually I did. I went down there and I helped overthrow the dictatorship.
Now, I mean, you're kind of like zooming through some things now. What was that, like, tell me about that experience. Like, so leaving the Marine Corps, so you left the Marine Corps.
Yes.
And then you went to Nicaragua.
No, I went to college.
You went to college.
I went to my education.
Okay.
A few years later, all the stars were aligned. That is, I was divorced, single, two children living with their mother. Mm-hmm. So the opportunity came up. So I invited myself to go down there.
Okay, well, let's back up. So you had the Marine. So you leave the Marine Corps, and then you start college.
Yes,
I see. And so tell me about where'd you do your undergrad?
University of San Francisco.
That's right.
Bachelor's degree in political science, master's in history.
Somehow this is all lining up here.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Even like the, so you do the military service, yeah. Then you do poli-sci, yeah. Government history.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. What's something that you, like from the early learnings, like that period of your undergrad, what did you like take away? What are key philosophies or?
Well, I'm a person who likes to read. Mm-hmm. And I was also, it's a good university. And I think one of the most significant classes that I took were in philosophy.
Mm.
It's a Jesuit university, so they require philosophy. So I did, I took a lot of, it was a minor in philosophy when you finish. And I still love philosophy. And it's interesting because I've used it so much in the Marine Corps, in Nicaragua during the Civil War, and in my teaching. It's always there, always present.
What's a philosopher, like, what's your favorite philosopher? Like, comes to mind?
There are so many, but Plato,
okay,
Aristotle, Socrates, and I always remember, you know, Plato saying, education produces good men, and good men act nobly. The other guy, Aristotle, said, our love of the things of the mind does not make us weak. And then Socrates said, well, so many things, but the one thing I remember is when they asked him why he was so smart, and he said, my greatest wisdom is that I know how great my ignorance is. Mm-hmm. And I thought, hey, that was cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in fact, I sent him a telegram and said, hey, man, that was cool.
That's okay. Okay, so philosophy has helped you
in military service. It was further deepened in college as an undergrad, and you just kind of really stuck with it as a part of your life. So you're constantly reading about. You're a lifelong learner.
Yes. Okay. Right. Yes. All those things helped me through my college and the Marine Corps experience. All those two things, philosophy and the Marine Corps experience, were very helpful in my university. And then when I went to teach, they were there always.
So what was your first teaching opportunity? When did that start?
Well, I started in the school year of 1969-1970 at high school.
There was a lot going on then.
And that high school was great. Mm-hmm. I made friends with the students, and one of them eventually became a lawyer. We're still really good friends, and very good friends. And from there, I went to San Francisco City College, and I was a big star there. People really liked me because they didn't have that many Latino teachers. Mm-hmm. So I was the word got out in San Francisco. Hey, look, that Nicaraguan guy is teaching at City College, and people talked about me. I became a celebrity in the Nicaraguan community. And from there, I went to San Diego City College, where I stayed for the next 40 years.
Oh, wow. So that was like your home base then?
Yes, yeah. That became my home base.
Okay.
Yeah. I was teaching American government, U.S. history, Chicano history, and community development.
Mm. Yeah. What's community development? What do you mean?
Well, that basically was teaching the students about the community organizations and how we can work with them. And what they didn't have to have a specific skills, you just volunteer to work. I would give them a list of community organizations. People in those organizations would come to the class and talk to us about what they did. And so they were required to go visit at least one of those communities. Mm-hmm. And so it was very enjoyable. And it was a great educational experience away from the classroom. Kind of like on training, on the job training kind of thing.
Yeah, so it's like a thing we call them service learning projects.
Exactly.
How do you think that contributes to students, I guess, academics and maybe their holistic development?
Well, they're learning in the classroom. Mm-hmm. What it's like to serve, what it's like to think and see things from a different way. They might have walked by that organization 1,000 times, but it never sank on them what they did and why they were important. Now they know. So next time we walk by there, say, oh, wow, that's what they do. So I went through the various organizations and I explained, and sometimes they had they brought speakers to my classroom, and that was important, combining the two.
Okay, and so 40 years at City College, what are some of the highlights that stand out to you? Because I imagine you've seen thousands of students, and I'm sure there's a few that you were able to mentor.
Oh, yes. To this day, I get letters from them. Sometimes some guy said, oh, yeah, I was in your class 30 years ago, and I remember you well. And one guy even put the letter on my Facebook page because he didn't know how to contact me. And so it's very beautiful, some of the letters that they write to me. A couple of students who were in high school, Kearney High School, contacted me. One of them, a Japanese-American girl, I always remember her really well. And she's a medical doctor now at UCLA, and she's teaching at the medical school. Mm. And he told me how she remembers me and grateful for what I did. And the other young guy said, I'm sorry, I apologize. I was not your best student, except now he's a medical doctor.
Mm.
And that was great to hear from him.
Mm.
Yeah, we're still in touch, yeah. Mm. So I had many letters like that, yeah. Mm.
So what is it, what's the secret? What is it that you were mentoring, what is that?
Well, I have thought about that. I think teaching requires craft. You have to know how to keep things in order, correct your papers, be careful, return the papers. All that is the craft of teaching. Mm-hmm. There's another one that is, teaching is an art. Mm-hmm. And you have to develop that and continue working on it. I have to be honest with you. I think I was born to teach. Mm-hmm. I have no clue about that. Never thought about becoming a teacher. Mm-hmm. I graduated from college and I still didn't know. But one day I saw a sign published by a newspaper that they delivered to your house, and it had a big sign. It said, UC Berkeley, the Latino Project. We are looking for Latinos who are bilingual and bicultural with a BA degree. And I looked at it, and that moment I felt God hitting me over the head with a newspaper. I said, here, you idiot, this is what I want you to do with your life. Mm. That moment, that sign changed my life. Mm. It changed my life completely. I was in a high. Mm. And 40 years later, I still felt that high.
Mm. Mm. Wow. So it was just a paper on just on the wall somewhere. And
yeah.
That was it.
And the newspaper just
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
And that's fate.
Yeah.
I just picked up the paper, went through it.
Yeah.
And I saw the advertising.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And just a newspaper. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And then so you put yourself out there, like you read that newspaper and you could envision yourself, and it just that spoke to you.
Well, they wanted to young Latinos mm-hmm. to go and work in the inner city schools, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. means in the poor neighborhoods. And they didn't have very few teachers in the schools at the time. Well, they did have, you know, cafeteria workers, janitors and all that, but no teachers. Mm-hmm. So I thought, like, my life's mission to go there and turn their world upside down mm-hmm. for the better.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, it was all hard. The brains came later because you kept learning and learning until the day you finish and you think, wow, I could have done this better. Wow, I could have done that. But I knew I was feeling that love from the students all along.
So when you started, you really focused on, like, building a connection with them? Like
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it worked. It worked really well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I could feel their response.
I mean, you're kind of giving it to me right now, but so as we continue to reflect on your career, what would you say are some of the core values that guided you as an educator and mentor?
Well, my first feeling was I have to serve this community.
Mm-hmm.
I have to make a change in this community.
Mm-hmm.
I have to remember that I don't know everything, but keep learning. When I share my knowledge with them, I realize how great my ignorance was.
Mm.
So that means it's a constant learning process.
Mm.
You never know everything. You have to use humility, because after a while you think you know everything, because students ask about everything. Sometimes they ask you, hey, where can I get a brain transplant? And you know, you don't have to feel obligated to answer that. And I would say, well, if anybody needs a brain transplant, you're looking at him.
Yeah, that's funny.
So, you know, anyway, so it's important to let them know that you don't know everything,
mm-hmm.
but that we can learn. I used to say, for example, look, if you don't know something, doesn't mean that you're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Example, if somebody tells you or me, can you fly an airplane? And you don't say, I can't. You say, I don't know how, mm-hmm. but if somebody's willing to teach me, I bet you I can learn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they call that now, there. Someone calls that, it was at a fixed versus a growth mindset. And so how do we promote students having growth mindsets?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Believing that you can do stuff. Okay, so if you could sit down with your younger self as a professor, what advice would you give about teaching and connecting?
Well, the first thing is the moment you stepped in the classroom,
mm-hmm.
without even saying a word, you're already communicating something to your students.
Mm-hmm.
The way you walk, don't walk like a homeless guy walking across the street. The way you walk, they judge you by that.
Yeah.
The second thing is, do not look like you've just been sucking up on the bitter lemon. Mm. You must have a happy face. If you can't do it, stand in the hallway and think about it, the funniest joke you can think about. So you walk in with a big smile. Mm-hmm. All this is the process of creating rapport. You must create rapport with your students. Mm-hmm. After that, if you make mistakes, they'll forgive anything from your mistakes. Mm-hmm. So that's some important things. The way you walk, the way you dress, you name it.
When you say building rapport, it makes me think about my training as a psychologist, and we talk about the therapeutic alliance, right? Really building that relationship with people, groups of people we work with. So it's really interesting to hear you as a teacher talk about the art and the craft of being a teacher and really highlight the importance of relationships.
As an example, one time, several times, I told my students, okay, go home and share with your parents what you are learning. And so one of the kids responded and said, yes, I went home and a Saturday morning, I asked my mom, hey, mom, I want to talk to you. Let's go to the kitchen. We had some coffee, and we had the best conversation we ever had. I was sharing with her, and she was sharing with me what she knew about the subject. And so it was great, a great exchange. Mm.
It's like you're reading my questions before I read them. Okay, so what's one memorable lesson? So you just shared one. What's another memorable lesson you learned from your students over the years?
Some of them were so beautiful. I could feel their love. Mm. One time, I leaned over, and we had a great discussion. But somebody came up, said the word, that bitch, and I said, you know, we shouldn't use that word. It's not a nice word. Mm-hmm. And this young lady to my right, she was actually from Laos, but I didn't know. She said, no. I said, she was very active in the class. And she said, no, that's not a bad word. Mm-hmm. I said, in fact, if you say that's a bad bitch, that's even better. And the class laughed. So I was being taught by my own students.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
About the culture out there. So we continued. And at one point, I just said, I was so excited. I said, I love Anna. And the class just laughed. Mm. And then I took it from there. Okay, guys, I said, when your mother was holding you as a baby, was that love? When you hug your mother or your little brother or your little sister, is that love? Mm. Do you love your best friend? Mm. There are so many types of love. Mm. So can you love a good person? Anna is a good person, just like you. Mm. So if I say I love her, it's what it is. Mm. And they didn't have an answer for that, but you knew they were listening, and they expanded. I always told them, look, you don't make love. That's different. That's fornication. Love is when you feel something for the person. I said, when my son was born, I said, I saw him being born, and I said to myself, I had nothing to do with that. That's a miracle, biggest miracle in the universe. And that moment, I felt God's presence. The room was full of God. He occupied the whole space. So I realized that that was a miracle, and I was there present for the miracle. And I think we can do something about that in the classroom, because they feel something that is hard to put your finger on, but they feel it, and they walk away thinking happy.
When students felt lost or discouraged, what strategies did you find most effective to help them reconnect with their goals?
Well, one thing is I always try to make them laugh. That's really important. Mm-hmm. Decreases the tension. The other thing is, you know, we've all been there. Don't feel bad. Today is bad, but tomorrow it's going to be better. If you need help, I'm always there to help you. But remember, today, we're having this conversation. But today is the first day of the rest of your life. Think positive. Mm-hmm. Another thing is, in general, to my students, but this particular person, I would say, look, there are some things that we get out of our doldrums: exercise, dancing, music, meditation, mindfulness, and prayer. Choose any of them. You will feel better. And so you give them hope.
They say hope is a dangerous thing.
Yeah, it could be. Well, I always say a story about that.
Yeah.
One day, as I felt sad and lonely and without a friend, a voice came to me and said, cheer up. Things could be worse. So I did. And sure enough, things got worse.
Stop. I see how you use humor. That's good. Okay, so listen, for my listeners, some of them may be afraid to go to office hours and talk to their professors. And sometimes I'm just, wait, you didn't go to office hours? And so there's this book, we had to read it during my undergraduate studies. It was Tuesdays with Maury. And it was like really sitting down with your professor. And I just always thought about that, like all the times that I was able to go to office hours and hear stories like what you're sharing with me and just the richness that comes of that. And so my question is, what role do relationships with professors, mentors, or peers play in a student's success journey?
Human relations is very important. Sometimes we don't think specifically about that, but we must always reach out. In my experience, I reach out to people I haven't seen in years. Some are relatives, some are friends. But very few of them have ever reached out to me. My students did. But usually people wait. But when you reach out to them, they feel happy. You can tell. And you talk about the old days. You talk about the good experiences. So we have to reach out. The individual. You have to take responsibility for the success of a two-way communication.
Now, you sent me some emails, and some of your emails, there's some really rich stories, and so hopefully it's okay to ask you this question about your dear friend, and I'd like you to tell the story. But it was a student and a friend who had a profound effect on your life, and my guess is that you had a profound effect on his life.
Yes. That was Augie Sandoval. He was my student, and after that, we became friends and stayed friends forever. And then one day, December 19th, 22, he died of COVID. Something interesting happened. Just before he died, he kept calling me on the telephone, telling me, hey, Mac, come over. They tied me down to my bed. Then he calls, hey, Mac, call the police and bring my brother with you. And this was like days before he died. We used to go to a restaurant in the barrio called Las Cuatro Milpas. He loved that. He had an emotional connection with it. And we used to talk about things. One day he told me, you know, Mac, when I was a little boy, we didn't get any presents for Christmas. And I thought we were the only children in the world who did not get presents. So he shared with me real deep, painful stories. But our friendship kept growing. And one thing about him is he always smiled. Even when he was in pain, he would smile. So when he died, I thought really hard. And I said, I had to say goodbye to him. So I went out, and just as they're putting his ashes on the ground, I wrote a letter. But the letter was for him, not to tell the audience how great he was. It was all about our friendship. And it worked out really great. In fact, it's interesting, but probably this is the first time ever that when they're listening to a eulogy of a person who's dead and we're about to bury him, the people laugh.
No, I believe you. I believe you. Oh, my goodness.
And I thought, oh, wow, Augie must be happy.
Yeah.
And I said, look, Augie, you know, I got some friends on the other side. I want you to meet them. But when I get there, don't forget, look for a Cuatro Milpas so we can go there and continue to have a good time together. So, and I know you're listening to me, so God damn it, I know you're smiling.
What was your favorite meal from Cuatro Milpas?
Well, the fact that he had this emotional connection, that it took him to his childhood of poverty, and that he identified with it, with these people. It was a husband and wife, Mexican immigrants, who came and built this little restaurant, and it kept growing.
And they only take cash still, right?
Only cash.
Only cash. Okay, and then Augie had a grandson, too, that I think you are part of his life as well?
Well, I did keep in contact with him.
Yeah.
And I graduated last year from a Christian school.
Okay.
And unfortunately, I'm still working with him because he did not go to college.
Ah, so you're working on him.
Yes. Okay. His grandfather was in the Army. So I called him when he was just graduating. I said, "Hey, Ezequiel, listen, what are you going to do? Are you going to join the military?" "Yes." "Where?" "The Army." Then I said, "Hey, if I give you $20, would you join the Marine Corps?" And he just giggled.
That's funny. So what's the message that you have for Augie's grandson, and how would that message be relevant to our listeners?
Well, I just got to talk to him about his grandfather's dreams. He was all about education, And so that's the way I am approaching it. I'm not putting any guilt on him because he hasn't decided yet to go.
So you're a firm believer in the power of education. Can you say more about that?
I think education does something to us. It's hard to put the finger on it because it's almost like a spiritual thing. You feel it, and you feel refreshed. And in my case, I could see how that changes you as a person, improves you as a person. You can do more things for people. And, of course, for your own family, your own children when they come. Mm-hmm. So that's a nice feeling. But education is basically a transformation of you as a human being for the better.
Mm. So just looking at today's educational landscape, what hopes or dreams do you have for this next generation of students?
One most important thing is the press is full of, college is so expensive, blah, blah, blah. I won't listen to that. Mm. I won't listen to that. There are financial aid programs in all universities. There are scholarships, not just on the campus. They're everywhere for everything. If you're 5 foot tall, they have a scholarship for just people who are fat. If you're fat, they have a scholarship just for fat people. They have a scholarship for everything, but you have to work. Mm-hmm, you have to search them. Mm-hmm. And today it's easier. Mm-hmm. But that is one thing that they have to understand. Don't listen to all that BS. Just go for it. Look for a scholarship. You will find one.
Okay. Looking back, were there moments of failure or setbacks that shaped you meaningfully? And then how can students learn from setbacks in their own lives?
I would say that it's obvious that all human beings fail at some point or another. And I'll share with them how you fail and why and how you recover from it. I was a the original finalist for a White House fellowship. Mm-hmm. And I met this guy, and so he made it. I didn't make it, but we got to know each other. Later, when I was in Nicaragua working with the revolutionary government, he called me. He was working very closely with a lady, an African-American lady, member of the cabinet of Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm. So he called me. She wanted to go visit the revolution in Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. And so he contacted me, and I dropped the ball at that point. If I had helped him try to get these guys to invite her, may or may not have worked, but I think it may have. So I was not savvy enough to go everywhere and look for that help. Well, if I had helped him and the cabinet officer had come to Nicaragua, I would have been able to be in contact with Jimmy Carter, with her, make friends with her, and maybe even do a better deal than the White House Fellowship.
Mm.
So that was a major failure on my part in my life.
Mm.
So
how'd you forgive yourself?
Well, you can't win them all.
Okay.
Yeah.
So hopefully this... So I just wanted to read this excerpt from Revolution and Romanticism, In Search of Justice and Meaning. I just want to read a small part. Who knows who or what keeps some out of harm's way? I survived several other incidents that I chose to call divine intervention. Confucius had a different take on it. It's wise to submit to destiny, he said. I had already submitted to destiny when I volunteered for this daring encounter with death. One day, lost in thought, I walked across an empty field. Suddenly, I noticed small patches of dirt jumping all around me. I turned around and noticed an airplane firing its 50 caliber guns at me. By the time I hit the ground, the plane was gone. A few inches closer, Confucius and I would have been engaged in lively conversations. What is that? Yeah, what is that?
That, I think, is a destiny. Hmm. Why not me? When all these young kids were dying all around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, that was a good time to die. I mean, it was so close.
Mm-hmm.
There were many other experiences that was so close and nothing happened. I was going down this trail, and then a few minutes later, maybe an hour later, this young guy walked down the same trail. He was killed by a sniper. I said, why him and not me? So there were those experiences. I was in this small adobe house from a little farm, and suddenly the earth shook. A huge shell landed right next to the little house. Why not right on top of it?
Mm.
The waves of the explosion made the walls wave like shits in the wind hanging. And I go, whoa. So I ran out of there. And that was that. I wasn't afraid. I was just, hey, man, this is not going to happen again. I'm not going to stay here for a second show.
I'm not going to wait to find out what happens next.
Yeah. Another time I was sitting with this girl who was super sharp, sharp lady, young lady. We were sitting at night. We were really tired in those chairs. And there was a pickup truck in front of us. And we were drinking our coffee early in the evening. And suddenly a huge shell landed just in front of the pickup truck. So all this dirt fell on top of us. It was over. When it was over, we just continued drinking our coffee, sticking our fingers in the coffee cup, pulling out the bugs, and just throwing them out. I remember that. It was just incredible.
Hmm.
We just sat there talking. So, you know, it's... I was never afraid, and I think if I had died from one of those big shells, it would have been fun, because you don't feel anything, and you never expect it. You just out of nowhere. Another thing that was interesting too, that when we went out and faced the other guys, we had these songs that we sang, and they were just inspiring and beautiful. The other guys were fighting for the dictatorship. They were scared. They say, oh, wow, who are these guys singing away? Like they're at a party somewhere, and here we are, nothing to show for it. And so I thought that was beautiful. And when we were out there going toward them, singing our songs, I thought, wow, this would be a beautiful day to die.
Mm.
It's unlike, kind of like Voltaire, just before he died, he was on deathbed, and a priest was telling him, a friend of his, hey, Voltaire, denounce Satan, denounce Satan. And Voltaire said, amen. This is no time to be making new enemies.
That's good. That's good. Oh, my goodness. Okay. I got to focus. Let's see. What's one book, piece of art, or idea that has profoundly influenced your perspective on life, education and life, but just life?
Well, there's a book that I read about five times, Dr. Zhivago. it has passages in there that just inspire me. I read them. It's just fascinating, Dr. Zhivago. Another book that is really good, every soldier should read it, All Quiet on the Western Front. And one is narrated by a young 19-year-old soldier, German soldier. And one of the things that is important is that he says, you know, here I'm trying to kill the other guy. I don't know him from Adam. He's never done anything to me, but that's what I'm doing. And I don't know why. The other thing he said was, the soldiers who are facing death, they become like brothers. They offer each other help. They do things that normally we don't do in a normal world. And there's many passages like that in the book that are so inspiring. And I still feel that when our young guys go to Iraq, Afghanistan. Here they are in their neighborhood, and the next day they are in Iraq, in Afghanistan, killing people who have not done any harm to them, ever. So, same in Vietnam. Yeah.
So how do you make sense of that? Like, I don't know if that's a duality, or I don't want to characterize what that is, like that phenomena, but...
Well, war is a strange phenomenon. You have a young kid, super straight, good student, finishes high school, maybe he wants to join the armed forces. And so there he is. Next thing you know, he's in Iraq, Afghanistan. Situation presents itself, and he kills another human being. Something he will never do in the other world. And sometimes they do things that affect their minds. They come back, and they can't believe they went through that. Now, the justification, in my opinion, is if they put you in a cage and the two of you are out to kill each other, they're both going to try and do it. One is lucky enough to kill the other guy, or the other guy feels lucky because... So they are put in a situation that they cannot win. The ones who survive, sometimes they come back all messed up emotionally. Some of them become homeless. They use drugs, alcoholics. But the upper classes don't suffer that. Very few officers fall apart. Very few. And the higher up you are, the further from the battlefield you are. So, and then many who go there are just support troops. They never see the enemy. They are as safe as you are in your own house. And the guys in the front line, they call them, well, in the Marine Corps, they call them rear echelon motherfuckers, R-E-M. And it is a funny saying for the Marines because it takes five soldiers to support each soldier that is in the front lines. So you have to have somebody in the back. It's the draw of life that you're sent over here instead of over there. But you are a normal human being. Next thing you know, at point blank, you may be killing somebody. And you would never, ever in your life think of doing something like that. You wouldn't even kill a dog or a horse. But yet now you're killing a human being. And you're a young guy. And that comes back to haunt you sometimes.
Yeah, so so what do you recommend for, I guess, our listeners who maybe have served and now they're in college and they have to come back and figure that out and start a new career? And how are you able to, you know, be successful after your 7 years in the,
Well, in college, I didn't have any help from anybody. I was on my own. Totally on my own. And I had 4 years of a GI Bill, but didn't begin to pay for everything. But it was a big help. I never thought about being, my mother being a sweatshop seamstress. I love her. She was the best mother. I just push and push and push. And I was happy going to college. I was really happy. Just like I was in the Marine Corps, I was very satisfied, fulfilled. In college, the same. Totally different worlds, but I was always felt fulfilled. So I think I was lucky in the sense that I liked everything I did. Mm-hmm. I felt fulfilled. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that works that way, or mm-hmm. for it doesn't work for everybody. Mm-hmm. Some people have to suffer. Mm-hmm. But don't get me wrong, I had some serious time. Mm-hmm. I mean, my father, I saw my father for the first time when I was 14 years old.
Oh, wow. What was that like?
Well, one good thing about him is he always wrote to us, sent postcards. He was a merchant marine out of San Francisco.
So you followed in his footsteps. Merchant marine. Yeah, different, yeah, but yeah. Marine and marine still. Yeah, okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So he was good.
Okay.
And he paid for the best school in Nicaragua, a Christian Brothers, La Salle schools. So that was really good. So he didn't abandon, he didn't divorce us. Mm-hmm. Not that he married my mother, but he didn't abandon us. Mm-hmm. And he brought us to the U.S., which my wife keeps saying, oh, I'm so glad you came. I'm so glad you came. Mm-hmm. My likes, my loves could have never been fulfilled if I had to stay in Nicaragua. There's no room there for my instincts, for my brain, for my likes, for my dislikes. There's just no room there.
So your life would have been different.
Totally
different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here I feel that I push as far as I could, developing my personality, my intellect, and so I can't complain. Hmm. Hmm. And so many immigrants have accomplished things like that, or better, or more. Mm-hmm. So,
what do you think contributed to you being successful as an immigrant in the U.S.?
You know, when I was in college, there was that the counterculture, they call it. Everybody was talking about marijuana, but in those days it was LSD.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. Well, I went through all of that. I was 2 blocks away from the Haight-Ashbury district.
What's that?
That's where the hippies and the counterculture began.
I see.
Yeah, and famous people came there, and some died, some went to die later. The Grateful Dead was there.
I see.
Of my professors said, yeah, the other day we had a picnic, professor, and we call ourselves the Grateful Living. Yeah. So, but what's interesting, as I look back, I used to go there all the time to the bank because I worked for the credit union on the campus. Mm-hmm. It was just like 10-minute walk, and I was right in the middle of that. The music, everything. But for some reason, it was another world for me. I was so focused on my studies that stuff didn't affect me. I never felt the need to go and experience it.
Okay, so no, what I'm hearing is identity, meaning, and purpose. That's what I'm hearing. Like, you had a sense of who you are and the sacrifices that your parents had made for you to be here.
Yes.
And you were going to live a life of meaning and purpose. Like, that seems to be clear.
Well, that's how it turned out. I guess that's something in my heart, in my conscience, that I wanted to. And so I just pursued that. Mm-hmm. I was just the person I was.
Yeah, but when I work with men, what I keep observing and noticing is that when we have a sense of, like, identity, meaning, and purpose, we know what our goals are, right? Then you don't want to go out to the club and party and do these things because you're focused on, you know, what it is that you're doing. Like, I was working with a student who's training to be a PT or a thoracic surgeon, like that's his, you know, goal, right? Oh, and so they're locked in, right? Like, they have to memorize these things. They don't have time to, you know, right? And so that's what I'm hearing you say, right? Like, I just, okay, y'all keep the cannabis and LSD. I got somewhere I'm trying to go.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I remember thinking, when I was in college, I didn't have that much money to spare, mm-hmm. but I was so busy, I didn't have time to spend the little I had. Mm. When I became a teacher, when I had money, I was so busy teaching that I didn't have time to spend that money. So it was the same thing. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Okay, so you were able to come to one of our classes and meet this, you know, current generation of young men of color as that's the course that I'm teaching. Mm. And so I think that they really appreciated you coming in. And hopefully you come back and visit us again on the Home Base podcast, but also come back to the class again. I think the students enjoyed your stories. So how was it for you visiting with us?
It was wonderful to see young people committed to their education. And based on how they expressed themselves, it was really rewarding for me to see that the young generation, we have some really good people there. People are ready to change the world.
Yeah. No, they're ready. They're locked in, these kids. Yeah. Yeah, they're ready. I call them kids, but they're grown men, 18.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
So before we wrap today, what's one thing that you want our listeners to know that you haven't yet shared with us?
Well, I would say one thing I haven't shared with you guys is that one thing I used to say in class and had a very good reception, I would say, you know, guys, I am the most handsome, the most intelligent, and the funniest teacher on this campus.
That's good. That's good. That's good.
Always got a good laugh.
Yeah. No, that's good. Let's see here. Yeah, no, as I was preparing for our talk today, I was thinking about just developmental theory. And so there's this theorist, Eric Erickson, and he talks about different things that we have to make sense of as we grow across time. I'll say it that way, as we grow across time. And he talks about, for like young adulthood, this idea of intimacy versus isolation, right? So like with the students on this campus, they're merging into adulthood and they're learning how to build relationships. And that's a lot of what you've talked about today. Then I'm kind of in this middle adulthood stage, right? Generativity versus stagnation. And in middle adulthood, it's like, how are we generative? How are we teaching? How are we supporting other folks? And then as we move past that stage, we get to this integrity versus despair. And so as I listen to your life, you've really lived a life of integrity, right? And you getting letters from your students and your mentees. And so I'm really sitting with that. And Erickson has this idea. He believed if we feel fulfilled and true to our values, we experience a sense of integrity. We look back and feel satisfied, seeing our lives as meaningful and valuable. And so as I sat with you today, that just really resonated with me. It sounds like you've lived a life of meaning.
I think so, but I wasn't thinking consciously about that. I was just doing what was in my heart. And maybe that's how you define it, how you see it, how you, you know, how you explain it. But yes, meaning, definitely, there was meaning in my life in terms of what I was doing.
Absolutely. And so, right, like relationships, it's key. And that's what I think developmental psychologists talk about. But then your life is a testimony of that. And so the importance of relationships and connection, the importance of seeking purpose, even if it's small, right? So I'm just really sitting with this idea of bombs being dropped around you and just sitting here drinking our coffee and taking the bugs out of it. I'm really sitting with that. And then finally, this idea of integrity, staying true to yourself and your values. And so at each of these different stages throughout our lives, college students are at this place where they're transitioning into adulthood, or some are transitioning out of a military career, right? And trying to figure out, how do I make sense of my identity, meaning, and purpose in this next stage, this next transition? And so I think what you've shared today is an amazing example of that, of really being committed to who you are and really staying true to yourself. So thank you so much for joining us on the Home Base podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it. And remember to subscribe for more content on living your best life. Stay curious, stay inspired, and keep building the future you want. I'm Dr. Pope. Peace. The Home Base podcast is a student success podcast recorded at the Digital Humanities Center at San Diego State University Library. Like, follow, subscribe. Find us on IG at SDSU_homebase.